Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a bi-weekly show about gardening, agriculture, and local producers meant to encourage, empower, and educate gardeners. We strive to provide diverse voices by interviewing experts and garden enthusiasts. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. In this episode, we're talking about apples. The history of the apple tree. It is remarkable how closely the history of the apple tree is connected with that of man. The apple was early so important and so generally distributed that its name, traced to its roots in many languages, signifies fruit in general. Melon, or melon in Greek, means an apple, also the fruit of other trees, also a sheep, and any cattle, and finally, riches in general. The apple tree has been celebrated by the Hebrews, Greeks, Romans, and Scandinavians. Some have thought that the first human pair were tempted by its fruit. Goddesses are fabled to have contended for it. Dragons were set to watch it, and heroes were employed to pluck it. The tree is also mentioned in at least three places in the Old Testament, and its fruit in two or three more. Solomon sings, "As the apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons." And again, "Stay with me, flagons, comfort me with apples." The noblest part of man's noblest feature is named from this fruit, the apple of the eye. From Wild Apples by Henry David Thoreau, 1862. In this episode, we talk to two Daves, Dave Shorer and Dave Erickson, about growing apples in Homer. Kyra Wagner of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District has our Tech Minute, where she talks about cold compost. And Nicole Arevalo has your weekly roundup of current events happening in local ag. Let's get started.
I'm Dave Shore. I've been in Homer since 1953. I came to teach school and taught here for 30 years, retired in 1982. In 75, we moved out east where the golf course is, and we built the golf course there, raised our two kids. Then in 1995, Yule Kilcher's brother approached me. I was working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, building the golf course and whatnot. And on one of our anniversaries, my wife Beth says, "I'm going someplace. You want to come with me or not?" I figured maybe it's time to cut back. So we sold the golf course to Edwin Kilcher in 95. And the Kilchers ran it until 2011. And they decided they'd had enough, and so they let it go into the hayfield. So the next year, we bought the golf course back. Then we brought the golf course back to life. 2 years later, we found some buyers from Anchorage, the present owners, which was a godsend, because I was, at the time, 85 or 86, and it was just too much to handle. So anyhow, we have a nice place here, but a lot of our years were spent at the golf course area.
And other Dave, would you introduce yourself?
My name's Dave Erickson. I'm a long-term resident here in Homer. My parents homesteaded out East End Road in 1950. I basically grew up in Anchorage and went to school in Anchorage. After getting out of college, I moved back down here to Homer. I worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and then went into private environmental consulting. I did that for 40 years. Now I'm retired and gotten into raising fruit trees and raising bees.
So I'm wondering how you first began growing fruit trees.
Okay, in 1972, we bought the present property, 20 acres, where the golf course is now. We moved out there in 75, lived in a little house while we built our main house, and we moved in, what, the fall of 75?
76.
That's when I bought my first tree. It was a crabapple tree. I was coaching high school track at the time, and we went to a meet in Kenai and stopped at a nursery on the way home and had this crabapple tree. So on Mother's Day, I gave a crabapple tree to my wife, kiddingly said, from one crab to another. And that wasn't very nice. But anyhow, that's where I basically had my first start. And it continued adding a tree here and there. I was told that you couldn't raise apples in Homer. But at the time, there was an extension service. They had a fenced-in area that had fruit trees in it. It was totally neglected. And that gave me a little incentive. And then I met the Andersons, who probably had some of the first trees here in Homer in the late 40s, Virgil and Fred Anderson. And at least two of those trees are still in their yard today, a sweet cherry tree and an apple tree that I don't know the origin of it. So from 1975, when I got my first one, I had more trees there. But when we moved up here in 95, I tried to move some trees, but most of the trees were larger and couldn't be moved. And so I only was able to move one apple tree, which is now about 30, 35 years old. That's grown to about 70 fruit trees now in my orchard.
Dave Erickson, how about you? When did you first start propagating apple trees?
Well, I always wanted to try to grow some apple trees, but the common wisdom around Homer was that apple trees do not grow here, and only some species of crab apples will survive, but only marginally. Even the local nursery would not sell apple trees because they didn't grow here. They did sell some Dogel crab apples. So I bought two of those probably in 1973, planted them on our homestead, and one of them is still alive today. So that sort of indicated that some form of apples, crab apples, do grow here. About 35 years ago, I bought several different types of apple trees and planted them around my house, and they all died. Largely because the soil was too wet. I did not realize that apples do not like wet feet. We put in some real serious drainage, bought some more apple trees, and it corresponded to when the climate started changing around here and we started having warmer, earlier spring weather, and they flourished. So I bought some more and added to it, and in the last probably 30 plus years, I've only lost two since then. And we've had pretty good luck over the years, and now they're mature trees and heavy producers.
Dave, you didn't lose any to the rabbits in 2008, 9, 10, in that period?
No, I didn't lose any of my trees at all. I had a lot of rabbit tracks around.
See, I lost quite a few trees in that rabbit era. And of course, since then, I've caged them up at least 3 feet, and even found 3 feet isn't high enough.
Several years ago, I did receive a lot of damage from black bears. They would come in at night and send their young up into the tree to get the apples. And in the process, they would break the branches down. And in a couple of trees, they broke every branch. Wake up in the morning and the branches and the apples are laying on the ground. I'm not sure if they ate many of them, but they had a lot of fun climbing the tree. We also suffered from moose bark stripping the apple trees during hard winters. They never killed them, but they did damage them. All those trees did eventually come back. We've gone through kind of a long evolution of types of wire and types of devices to keep the moose out, and we have settled on this large concrete reinforcing wire. We put it around the trees every year, and we take it off in the spring. Since we've gone to that type of wire, we haven't had any problem.
When I built the golf course, I fenced the whole 10 acres by hand. So I had a little experience putting in fencing, and that was 7.5 to 8 feet tall. I found that it took that height to keep the moose out. So when we moved here, I fenced about 1/2 acre for my garden and the orchard, and that's probably the best thing I ever did to protect both the garden and the orchard. It's a regular cattle fence, and it's basically 7.5 to 8 feet tall.
So moving on, Dave Shore, I have been told that you keep very meticulous records. What are some things that you've noticed in your record keeping?
You know, I've tried to put a handle on it, and I've done some things. Like I have a chart here, a bloom chart for my apples and cherries. And I've grafted it so that I have high years when the trees bloom early, and the low years when they bloom later. The only thing I can kind of put my finger on is that it appears to me that we have cycles here in Homer, and especially living here since the early 50s, that we have 8, 9, 10 year cycles. We'll have a warm cycle, and then we'll have gradually down for 4 or 5 years, and then it goes back up. And the same thing, I've kept a graft of when we have our first killing frost. And I've noticed a pattern since 2000. There's a pattern that almost all the lines are on the other side of normal. In other words, we are having an increased number of days in the fall of a growing season. Climate warming, it shows evidence that we are getting warmer. But it's kind of interesting to note that we've had a frost as early as September 5th and as late as October 22nd in 2004. 15, and the earliest one was in 1980. For people who are going to start fruit trees and even in the garden, I recommend that you keep as detailed of a journal as you can. I can go back now and see when certain things bloomed and compare it to other years and know when to plant, and I keep track of when I harvest my apples, and my record keeping has really paid off for me, and I would highly recommend it to people starting out.
So this question is for the both of you. What varieties of fruit trees are well suited or best suited for our environment here on Ketchumak Bay?
Well, I've gone with a couple that are early apples. Those would be the yellow transparent, the Nordland, and the Harl Red. The Nordland is a, I would say, a foolproof apple. It's very vigorous, very hardy, produces sweet, medium-sized apples, and there are quite a few of them on the tree also. They don't keep very well, so that's not an apple that you want to store for the winter. But it's an easy apple. It grows very quickly. It's a good apple for the bench land here. Up in this orchard that we manage, we have 20 species. Most of them are doing very well. So I think there's a wide range of apples that will grow here now compared to when I planted my trees 30 years ago.
My favorite apple is the Parkland. There's a series of LAND, and they're somewhat related. There's the Parkland, there's Norland, there's Westland, there's Cortland, and so on. Most of these originated in Canada. Virtually none of our apples are keepers. In Walter Johnson's orchard that Dave is helping to manage, there are a couple varieties that I've learned that they have been able to keep them for, what, 4, 5, 6 months? But overall, our apples don't keep well. For people starting out, I would advise limiting yourself to start with Parkland and Norlands. I have about only 12 or 14 different varieties, and both the Parkland and the Norland are classified as early. Then there's mid-season apples and late apples. Don't even touch late apple trees as you see in the literature. They won't mature except maybe once in your lifetime or every 10 or 20 years. I have a couple of those I know from experience. So stick with Parkland and Norland as far as my suggestion. Another mid-season is Melba, but again, I want to stress the majority of our apples do not keep well. I've tried, I've experimented, and they just don't keep.
My next question, as an experiment, I bought a bag of apples from the grocery store. I saved the seeds and I germinated them. Can you explain what issues I might have trying to grow apples this way as opposed to purchasing an already propagated tree?
It's not going to work.
You took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say, don't waste your time.
Most all of the apple trees that you buy are propagated from a particular strain of apple, not by seed. You do not know where half of the genetic material came from. Now, years ago, Johnny Appleseed, the famous nurseryman, did not believe in grafting, and he would try to gather all these seeds and experiment with the seeds. It didn't work very well. He spread apples, most of them were inedible. So you don't want to rely on the seeds at all. So the best thing is to buy a tree from a reputable source. If you're starting out, you want to buy two different types because of cross-pollination. A lot of the apple trees are self-incompatible. Their own pollen does not fertilize the flower. You have to have a separate one to get the pollen from. And a lot of them only produce sterile pollen, so it doesn't work. So you need maybe a crab apple and a regular apple, or two distantly related. You don't want to have the same type of apples planted next to each other because they're essentially the same thing.
Going back just a moment to your question, Darryl Walker grew one from seed, and it was 5 or 6 feet tall, and I was visiting one day, and I took a signwood sample and grafted it on my big Parkland apple tree, and it took in two different places and produced an apple about the size of your thumb, not just one year, but But every year, the only other experience I have had, I'm having some luck with now, I started seeds from, Dave, help me pronounce it, Anavasta. It's a Russian rootstock.
Ananovka.
Very, very hardy, down to 50, 60 below. I gave a presentation to the Homer Garden Club about 8 or 10 years ago, and at that time, I distributed these seeds in a package among other seeds to everyone there. I haven't heard of any other person planting it. They're very difficult to germinate. I finally got two to germinate, and the only way that they'll produce an apple is to graft onto them, because the apple that will be produced on these trees will be about what I mentioned, about the size of your thumb. I also had another tree that came up from the rootstock, and it produced apples maybe twice that big, but they never matured and they were very sour. So don't waste your time, unless the only thing you could do, if you got that tree to grow, you could graft another one onto it. However, the rootstock from the seed that you plant isn't necessarily a good rootstock.
And some of these research facilities at universities, like Cornell and stuff, they will control the pollen that fertilizes the individual flower and then propagate those over a long period of time to select for genetic traits. And they will use the seeds to develop these new trees. But often, like Honeycrisp, it took decades worth of trials and crossbreeding in order to come up with the tree that we have now as a Honeycrisp.
For your apple trees, do you use grafting? And can you explain that process?
That's my hobby now, is grafting. I've done hundreds and hundreds of grafts. I got my first Honeycrisp about 5 years ago, and it froze out. So the oldest one I have now is 2 years old. But I took cuttings off the bottom of that, and I probably have 15 or so of those grafted onto other trees. But I've learned a lesson. You don't want to graft on large trees. You want to graft on small trees. Because on big trees, all the effort of that tree is going in to make a bigger tree. If you graft way down on the tree, then it gets some of the nourishment earlier. And right now, I do have, just 2 years old, I have some grafts from the Honeycrisp that are over 6 feet long in just 2 years. They've grown faster than my Honeycrisp, the whole tree has.
So going back to my question, how would somebody go about grafting if they were just learning or just starting out? Maybe just explain the process.
Well, you want to start early spring to get what's called scion wood. That's the annual growth from the previous year. And you want to use that for your grafting material. So it's something you want to do in the spring. The trees are pretty dormant at that time also, so you want to do it before their sap really starts flowing. The best way, I think, is to find a mentor that has experience in grafting and just spend some time with them, because there are little tricks that's going to save you a lot of headaches. It's something that you want to find somebody with experience and just go from there.
Are you looking for an apprentice?
Well, I agree with Dave that find a mentor. I have a very simple graft that works for me. I know I've grafted hundreds and hundreds of times, and my overall success rate is probably no more than 50%, even now. The problem is you have to graft at the right time where the nourishment is starting to flow in the tree, and the scion wood that you're grafting onto that is about at the same level. apple trees I've grafted as late as early June. It's critical that you have to have some flow from the mother tree to go into the cyanwood that you're grafting to make a successful graft. I would recommend, first of all, going online and reading about grafting. And then, again, get some experience and watch somebody locally do it, because what works outside may not work here. Another way that I heard of is you can cut the cyanwood or the end of the new growth off and simply stick it in the ground. Now, I know that that works to an extent, but it works better on certain things than other things. But I'm going to try the apple things, because when I prune, why not take a dozen of them and stick them in the ground and see what happens? You'd still end up with probably having to graft onto it. I don't know. It's another whole new world for me.
Yeah.
In looking at your orchards, all of your trees are outside. I know many people around town grow their apple trees in high tunnels. Can you talk about maybe the differences?
They are running into a few problems with pollination. You should buy, maybe I mentioned that before, we start with dwarf, semi-dwarf, and full-size trees. So most of those are probably planting dwarf or semi-dwarf trees that don't get too big.
That's one of the bigger problems, is they grow fairly fast. And high tunnels have a limited size. So you are spending a lot of time cutting them back each year, you know, to maintain at a certain size. That's a fair amount of work. Where they do live outside, and I've known several people that have taken the covering off of their high tunnel, and you know, because it's just too much hassle to close them all the time.
There are a couple people around here now. Mike Reardon bought Jim Manley's old place, and he's been at it for years, and he actually buys pollen and uses a spray gun to pollinate his trees that are inside.
So you had mentioned that there was maybe an issue of pollinating the trees if they were inside. What do you do for pollination?
I depend on Dave's bees to fly up here and pollinate for me. Pollination is very tricky. We have some trees that are self-fertile, which means they'll fertilize within the tree, and it's my understanding, and I might mention here that I have absolutely no training in this sort of thing. Everything that I've done is self-learned, and I Google a lot of things, but there's still a lot that I don't know, especially pollination. But the advantage I have is that I have so many trees. For someone starting out, when you buy a lone apple tree, your success is going to be minimal, because you need, for most apple trees, you need another tree, another different kind, to use as a pollinator. So the more trees you have, the more pollen is going to be available, and the results are going to be better for setting fruit. As I say, with Walter's orchard, who has, 20 different kinds, the problem is solved. We had a Southern Peninsula Fruit Growers Association here, started about, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago we disbanded it because nobody wanted to be an officer. At one time we had 100 names on our list, and that's been 10 years ago. 30 years ago there weren't probably more than a half a dozen apple trees. I would imagine now, with the high tunnels, with people getting interested, I'll bet you there are easily 1,000 or more apple trees in Homer. It's just spread like wildfire.
Now, another thing, when you're starting out planting an apple tree, you want to get a companion tree that blooms about the same time as your other tree. And often people use crab apples, even ornamental crab apples, because they bloom. They have a lot of blossoms. They have a lot of pollen, and they bloom for a longer period of time than a lot of apples. Our average bloom season around here is about 9 days. And it happens real quick. And those trees need to be pollinated or you get nothing. Even the self-pollinating trees, the ones that are self-fertile, need insects to do the pollination from flower to flower. And that's also a drawback with high tunnels, is if you plant a self-fertile tree, you still might not have enough insects in your high tunnel to do the job of pollinating. But we also have a lot of natural pollinators around here.
What are some things that you do to maintain the health of your orchards?
I have never fertilized my trees.
I have never fertilized my trees that I can remember.
You're waiting for him to say something first to see what he was going to say about it.
I don't use pesticides.
I don't either.
I try to do some rigorous pruning every year, and that's about it.
We have very few diseases here. We have an apple scab that I've never had. Have you had it?
I haven't at my place, but we have it up at the Johnson's Orchard.
But we're lucky here in Alaska that we don't have a lot of diseases around. But you still want to be aware that if things start to happen to your trees, check with somebody, because it's not impossible that it can be brought in. Just like the big slugs that we had.
I don't necessarily rake up a lot of the apples and leaves at the end of the season. Most years I just leave them decompose under the trees. Some people are a little bit more meticulous about having decaying matter underneath their trees.
For years, I had bare ground under my trees I could till, but it got too much for weeding and just too much work. So now I've tie-parred the whole orchard, but I leave the trees that, the leaves that blow in, even from other trees, and they'll scatter themselves around and decompose. And I think that's the main reason that we don't have to fertilize.
What are some other tips?
Don't worry about thinning your trees until the apples get maybe the half the size of a golf ball. I don't thin most of my trees at all because I have an agreement with the winery. They come and pick and use them to make wine, of course, and so they don't care what size they are. Sometimes you'll have as many as 5 apples form on a single cluster. They won't grow large. So what you do is thin them and maybe only leave 1 or 2 apples to a cluster. The couple trees that I thin for our use, I wait until they're at least the size of a golf ball or maybe a little less. And then I tend to shake the tree because even then some of those apples didn't get pollinated and will grow maybe half size and still drop off. But then after about golf ball size or a little less, I will start to thin 1 to 2 apples per cluster.
Up at the Walter Johnson Orchard, we had peak bloom the 6th of June. Then the petals started falling off. It was very obvious. We will do basically nothing, let them be, until probably the second week in July when we will go up there and thin. We try to leave 2 apples per cluster, but when you have a 10-foot ladder and you still can't get up high enough to thin those little apples, we sort of let them go.
And so, by the way, very important, on a new tree, don't let all of your apples set on a new tree. In fact, the first year that tree produces, I wouldn't let more than a couple apples on it. And if you can even just get rid of all of them the first couple of years, you're better off. But I know that people with new trees want to have some fruit, so let 2 or 3 apples set the first year, double or triple that the next year, and so on. But you want the growth to go into the tree, not into the fruit, the first few years.
And I assume maybe the tree isn't strong enough to hold that weight?
That's another whole new ballgame that goes into pruning. If you train your tree right, the limb will form a saddle on the trunk of more growth that will hold that limb and hold more apples on that limb. But if you don't train them right, I've had many limbs split off. But it's very important to prune your trees so that they will hold the weight of the apples that you let on. This goes against probably what most people say, but I prune any time of the year that I feel it needs it. But I don't prune over 10% at any one time. Other sources will tell you to prune in the spring or in the fall, but again, with 70-some trees, it's a job keeping up with them all. You should keep the middle of the tree clear of branches and open as possible in the middle of the tree. Otherwise, if the tree gets too tight, too many leaves, your apples won't ripen. Even now, with getting the apples to the winery, the trees on the south and the west side will ripen before the trees on the north or the east side. So you can get a lot of help, again, on the internet, but pruning is kind of an art in itself. Do you prune up there?
We prune in the early spring, once the snow is off the ground, and we hit it pretty hard once. Throughout the year at my place, I do snip off the water sprouts that sprout throughout the tree anytime throughout the summer. It doesn't hurt them.
What are water sprouts?
There's these little sprouts that come up in inconvenient places from the base and the middle of the tree, just long, thin branches.
And one more clarifying question. Before, you had mentioned something called the king flower.
The apple has a cluster of six blossoms, and one will be like the first and the biggest to ensure maximum pollinization, or that fruit will set. And then these minor flowers can get fertilized, but the king flower is the biggest and the first of the cluster.
What advice can you give to a first-time grower?
Well, one of the things that I would strongly encourage anybody that wants to get into growing fruit trees is to pay a lot of attention to the fence around your tree. It's very, very discouraging to plant this little thing and see it grow up several years and to have a moose eat it to virtually nothing. That's one of the reasons I think that the myth of apple trees didn't grow here, because nobody put a fence around their apples when they planted them.
Okay, a couple of basic things. If you get new trees, south slope is by far the best. Look for a microclimate. By a microclimate, I mean it's protected. I'm fortunate here that I'm not only on a slope, but I have protection from alders and other trees from the southwest. I just found out something that I never even knew until I was rereading this. But our general wind direction from May, June, July, August, September is the southwest. The other months of the year, it's from the northeast. So especially you want protection in your months of the year that your fruit is growing and maturing from the southwest wind. Also the soil. As Dave mentioned earlier, they don't like wet feet. And so choose at least a slight slope to plant them on. And you don't want to bury them too deep or too high. Planting your trees distance-wise, all of us make the mistake of planting them too close. I probably have mine on the average of 12 feet when they should be 20 to 25 feet. But that depends on what tree you want. If you're having a dwarf tree, you get a spread of maybe 6 feet at the most, 3 feet on either side. You can plant another tree 12 feet away. But I have an apple tree out here that's 35 years old that is 25 feet high, and it shades out some of the other trees that were planted too close to it. I would say a minimum of 15 feet, even for dwarf trees. If you're going to get a full-size tree, make it 20 or 22, 25 feet apart. Most people don't have the space, so go to a dwarf or semi-dwarf tree.
I noticed that you have certain plants that you've planted in the shade. I think I saw comfrey, blue Himalayan poppies. Is that a conscious choice? Are there certain plants that do very well as a companion in the shade of the apple trees?
I haven't found it so. I put flowers down there because I spend quite a bit now, especially in my old age, just sitting, watching them bloom, and I get tired, and so I have a chair to sit down on, and I enjoy the flowers that are in the orchard. But no, I'm not aware that there's any companion that helps the trees.
It's very difficult when you buy a couple small trees from the nursery to put them 25 to 30 feet apart. You have to exercise some self-discipline in doing that. And I would advise people not to plant them in front of their view. Some of these apple trees get pretty big. It's a shame to cut them down 25 years later because they're in your view.
How long is the lifespan of an apple tree?
In the wild, in Central Asia, where they've gone and looked at the origins of apples, they've found some trees up to 700 years old. Very massive, with lots of broken down limbs and stuff, but still alive that old. They can live a long time in the wild. Fending off diseases and stuff like that, it's a lot tougher in a standard orchard, you know, but they can last 100 years.
The oldest one I know in Homer is where Maren Anderson lives. Her father, Fred, planted them back in the 40s, so they would be at least 80 years old. Just a couple quick other things. Make sure you have good drainage when you plant your tree. Wind protection. I find wind protection is one of the keys to successful growing of fruit trees. If you get that southwest wind coming in every day and don't have something to help protect it, you're not going to get very much production. And the other thing is elevation. I would say anything above 500 feet, I would stretch that to 600 feet elevation, depending on whether you can find a microclimate. And by the way, even at Anchor Point, I have found very few people that have raised apple trees outside in Anchor Point. Anchor Point is just that much shorter season than we are. We're lucky here on the Homer Bench, but you get up over especially 500-600 feet and your chances are not good that you're going to have much of a crop. The elevation here averages about 325 feet. I happen to have a federal state combined weather station right up here, and they listed it as 352 feet right up above, 50 yards up here. At the bottom of my orchard, though, I have a drop of probably 60 or 70 feet. So that's, again, I've tried to raise apple trees higher in my garden without wind protection. I've lost all of them, or I've taken them out because they wouldn't produce. By the way, just one other little thing. We talked about moose fencing. Some years the voles and the other related small animals can chew a tree and actually kill it. I've used mothballs when my trees are young, and I put a couple at the base of the tree and it seems to deter them. I also used that when I was growing sweet peas on a fence. Every year the mice would come from under the deck and chew off some of those sweet pea. But by putting mothballs next to them, it deters the voles and the other mice and so on. I've been at this since 1975 when I first started and knew absolutely nothing. 25, 35, 45 years later, sometimes I think I still don't know anything about it. It's a learning curve, and you learn by experience. I like to experiment. I've probably lost at least 20 or 30 or 40 trees because I bought a nectarine tree for cold climates, and it just doesn't work, but I still have fun experimenting, especially with grafting. It's a nice hobby.
It's very humbling sometimes, especially when you think your trees are too old and the bark is too shaggy to ever interest a moose. So you don't put up the wire that year.
And if I would make one more comment, I'm getting up there in age. I'll be 92 next month. I have a right-hand woman here, my wife Beth, that is starting even to take over some of the help in the orchard, and especially in the gardening. And unless she wants to continue to do it, maybe it'll end up with Dave's group. But it's a thing that, you know, I put a lot of work and effort into it, and I would hate to see it just... Generally, when you sell a property, you don't sell it that somebody's going to take care of your orchard. So it presents some problems of passing it on, and Dave's group would probably be the one that would end up taking care of this orchard.
Are there any groups that are active in Homer that if somebody that is a younger person wanted to get involved in growing an orchard or helping to maintain other people's orchard, where would they learn?
That's the trouble with a lot of activities around Homer. The average age, like for the garden club, is probably way up there. And similar to the people that are interested in orchards and growing fruit trees, encouraging younger people to get involved is always difficult for a lot of these activities. But
you know, Dave, maybe that will change. The last 20 years especially, the fruit trees in Homer have really increased, and especially with the high tunnels. So maybe more of the younger people will see them growing. Whereas, you know, where I grew up in the Midwest, it was just a common thing to have a number of fruit trees in your backyard. Everybody did, especially during the Depression. Well, now maybe that they're more common in Homer, maybe the younger people might take a little bit more interest. Because I've had groups out here every year for many years. We had the kindergarten and first grade classes come out here, and most of them never saw an apple tree, because it's different up here than outside.
Yeah. I give a tour to a couple small children, and they ask the most interesting questions about the apple trees, having no knowledge whatsoever that apples came from trees.
Yeah.
Because in Homer, you know, where would they learn that?
Well, if there's nothing else...
You say if there's nothing else, Dave and I could go on for hours.
I know.
But we did. That's why we had a Fruit Growers Association. Because we would sit around up here, there'd be 20 or 30 of us, sometimes only five. But you would swap, and that's where I've learned the majority from the old timers, and some of the, now the younger people are learning from us. And that's the way it should be.
And that was Dave Shore and Dave Erickson, recorded earlier this summer on June 23rd, 2020. Up next is your Tech Minute.
This is Kyra Wagner with today's Tech Minute. Today we're going to be talking about compost. Compost is a very non-techy kind of thing you can do. You don't need any technology at all. You can just throw all of your plant debris in a pile and call it cold compost. Cold compost sounds like you know what you're doing. A lot of people admit they don't know what they're doing. They just put it in a pile. But actually, cold compost is a totally valid way. Nature does it all the time. Things are meant to decompose slowly, and it is a perfectly good way to not use any technology and yet get rid of all of your plant materials. If you would like to step it up a little bit, you can incorporate chickens into that pile. They'll turn it for you. Or you can put it in a barrel, and this is one of the things that I would suggest for the winter. If you collect all of your kitchen scraps and your different plant debris into a barrel, you can then move it around later, put it wherever you'd like. The one thing about that, over the winter, the freezing and thawing cycle will be helping break down all of your material in that barrel. One of the things it'll also create is an amazingly stinky sludge at the bottom of your barrel that you will never want to deal with. So there are a couple ways to get around that. You can use a barrel that's got holes in the bottom, or you may see specific composters that don't actually even have a bottom on them. So you can keep everything in a nice tight pile so it is really as active as that cold compost is ever going to get. And yet it's draining out all of that anaerobic liquid into the soil so that your cold compost doesn't end up stinking. The other option that that provides you with is that you could move all of that cold composted icky goo over the winter that you collected and make a big compost event in the spring and have a hot compost pile. Now this sounds like you may have graduated to a much more complicated version of composting. Hot compost utilizes a nitrogen-carbon ratio that makes it heat up with all the microbial activity that are living off of that particular ratio. If you have enough nitrogen in there, you can get some microbes really breaking things down fast, and that's where your compost pile can get super hot, even hot enough to burn things down, so do be careful. You will have to turn that compost and keep it aerated so it doesn't get too hot. But nitrogen is volatile, and it disappears, so you have to have something that will hold it in place, keep it hot until you don't want it too hot, and then you'll need to flip it. So it does take a lot more activity, but it breaks down a lot quicker. So keep it simple, make it complicated, but always compost. You'll never regret it. This is Kyra Wagner with today's Tech Minute.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of agriculture-related opportunities and other fun tidbits. First up, fall soil sampling. It's that time of year. Bring samples of your garden soil to Homer Soil and Water. We'll have it tested and develop personalized recommendations for what you want to grow. We are now doing the forms and payments online, and we have a soils drop box out on our porch. So even if we're not in the office, you can bring down your sample. Instructions for collecting a sample, forms, and payments are at www.homerswcd.org. And another angle you might try, Earth Fort Testing Services is offering bacterial, fungal, and protozoa tests for garden soil. Go to www.earthfort.com to learn about what they offer and what testing microbes can tell about conditions in your soil. The University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension has a few upcoming online workshops to know about. Today, September 19th, an Extension Kitchen, Probiotic Pickles, 1 p.m. Thursday, September 24th, Fundamentals of Organic Gardening, 6 p.m. Thursday, October 1st, Canning Meats and Poultry, 1 p.m. And Master Gardener Terry Reichert will lead her annual 8-week gardening class by Zoom beginning September 28th. It will run from 6 to 8 p.m. on Mondays. Find information for all these classes at www.uaf.edu/ces. The information for the 8-week class can be found in an article from September 4th on the news section of their homepage. All other online workshops are at the bottom of the homepage. Fall is also the time for planting bulbs. Local garden stores are stocking them right now. Contact your favorite local greenhouse or garden store to find out what they're bringing in. And lastly, slugs. Slugs can be the bane of many a farmer's existence, but local growers have advice for a plethora of ways you can try to get rid of the slimy menace in your gardens. The following advice comes straight from a post on the Homer High Tunnel Growers Facebook page, where many a local grower weighed in. Get some ducks. They'll eat them. Some people even lend their ducks out to others for slug control, especially in high tunnels. Chickens. They'll eat them too. You might have to protect your perennials from the chickens, though. There is quite a list of things you might try to sprinkle either around your plants or around the perimeter of the growing area. Coffee grounds, broken eggshells, or crushed oyster shells. The soft slug bodies get cut, and they might avoid the crossing. Other similar suggestions are ash from a wood stove or a bonfire, sand barriers, these have mixed reviews, and diatomaceous earth. That's a powdery substance that's actually made up of fossilized diatoms from the seabed, very fine, sharp little particles. Again, soft slug bodies are said not to like crossing these barriers. Just know that ash, sand, and diatomaceous earth don't work as well if they get wet. Sluggo. It's a product you can buy at garden stores. All natural, and people swear by it. The half-buried cup of beer in the ground trick. Replace the beer every few days. Others said rooibos tea sweetened with a little soy milk was a happy accidental draw for the cup trick. One person said that slugs love rotten bananas. Put one in a bowl with a little liquid. And for what it's worth, I found that they love the food in my dog's bowl too. A couple people advised spraying ammonia on them. And another way, no tricks involved, is to go around and hand-pick them around dusk. Or lay a piece of plywood on the ground and they'll use it as a daytime hiding place. Pick them from there. Also, look out for their eggs buried in the top layer of soil, their round, clear little balls. Remove those on sight, but don't destroy the milky-looking ones. Those are worms. Worms are good.
And that's it for this episode. I want to thank the two Daves, Dave Shorer and Dave Erickson, for talking to us about apples. And if you're ever looking for an apprentice, I do know a lady who's interested in grafting, doesn't mind getting on ladders, and enjoys making cider. Thanks, as always, to Homer Soil and Water Conservation District for contributing content to this episode. Thank you to the amazingly talented local musicians, Carly Konomak and Kevin Cope, for providing our theme music, and also Kevin Cope and Ryan Black for our outro music. Questions, comments, and criticisms can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer.